You're with Nadia Mitsopoulos on ABC Radio Perth.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. Lovely to be with you this morning. I wonder how many of you jump onto the My School website to check out the NAPLAN results of your school and then compare them to other schools. Is it what you use to measure a good school? Now, you hear a lot about NAPLAN, the pressure on students to perform well, the pressure on teachers to prepare them well, and how principals use the results to showcase their schools. But there are lots of other tests as well, in pre-primary to assess language, reading, writing, and it continues right through to year 12. And there is value in knowing where a student is at and meeting their educational needs. But I wonder when it becomes too much. That is my focus this morning.
Focus Perth with Nadia Mitsopoulos on ABC Radio Perth.
And to explore this with me this morning is Professor Brian Caldwell. He is a former Dean of Education at Melbourne University. He now runs Educational Transformations, which undertakes research projects in all areas of education for governments as well as for non-government organisations. And also Esther Hill. She's director of the Beyond Boundaries Institute at All Saints College. Professor Caldwell, you've been looking at the education system of 13 different countries. What countries did you look at and what were you specifically looking at?
Well, the 13 countries is a long list, but I'd highlight seven of the world's top performing school systems, and they were Canada, Finland, Estonia, Singapore, South Korea, Japan. These are countries that we were able to benchmark Australia's performance on a whole range of issues. The primary interest we had was how different levels of government align their efforts to develop strategies that have led to high performance among students. So that was the main focus, how governments work together.
And what did you find there? What works?
Well, the highest performing systems of education have nowhere near the complexity of government that we have in Australia. We've got extensive involvement of both federal government and state governments. In the only comparable country, which is a federation of those that we looked at, Canada, the federal government has no role at all in school education. In fact, its constitution forbids it. And so education is in the hands of provinces or the equivalent of our states. But when you go to the other countries that are not federations, like Estonia or Finland or Japan or Korea or Singapore, where there is a national level of government, at the very most, those levels of government might provide a large amount of money, but without strings attached, and also might provide a broad framework. But here in Australia, particularly come election time, looking ahead to New South Wales, where there'll be a federal election and a state election within a matter of weeks, you have opposition and governments in both federal and state spheres presenting policies for education. It's far too complex, and we need to simplify that if we look at these comparisons that we've been able to make.
And so you would argue that it's only state governments and territories here that should be involved. You get some funding from the federal government, but all the policy decisions, leave that to that state level.
Absolutely. Our states, and especially including Western Australia, are well able of their own expertise at both the system level and the school level to create a world-class system of schools, no matter where the school is located. The Constitution tells us that the states are responsible for education, and the federal government has only been involved for the last 50 years, and especially for the last 20 or so, has become increasingly involved in what's a flow-on effect on schools. So essentially, we've got two levels of government telling schools what to do. Far too complex, needs to be simplified, reduce the paperwork for principals and teachers. But that's just one of the findings that we've made in the international comparisons.
And one of the other findings, and this is where I want quite a bit of the focus to be this morning, is overtesting. And you find that students in Australia are overtested. Because we have those two levels of policy coming from state and federal government, it means we also have testing requirements that come from state government and federal government. Is that a big problem?
Oh, this stands out like a lighthouse in the international comparisons. Absolutely none of the world's top performing school systems would dream of having national tests at two levels of primary and two levels of secondary. And that's what we've got in Australia. Our students are beset with these national tests at years 3 and 5, and then again at secondary school at years 7 and 9. By the age of year nine, I think students are well aware of the fact that for them, these tests are actually low stakes, and their performance in them doesn't count anything for them personally. But they have nevertheless had huge pressure put on them by their schools and through the whole national testing regime, so that they feel they have to do well, which we hope they would, of course. But among the top performers, there aren't national tests that are compulsory for all students in all settings. In Finland, for example, national tests are available, and municipalities and schools may choose to do them or may be required to do them, but they're not compulsory at any level of schooling for all students. So In my view, in these international comparisons that I've been able to make, at the very least, we ought to reduce these national tests in the short term to, say, year 5 and year 9. But all of this, of course, is dependent on teachers having the skills to test or assess well, especially at year 3 level or entry to primary school, and year 7. And increasingly, our teachers are becoming very skillful at testing. But nevertheless, that ought to be a major outcome from initial teacher education. That is, that teachers know how to assess well and more or less continuously.
Okay, a few issues that we need to explore there. Now, you single out NAPLAN, and I want to bring Esther Hill into this discussion now. She's the director of the Beyond Boundaries Institute at All Saints College here in Perth, because Brian Caldwell there talks about NAPLAN, but there are so many others, aren't there? Because there's a lot of other standardised tests that need to be done that start in pre-primary.
Yes, I can't talk specifically too much about the pre-primary testing regimes, but certainly standardised testing is very much part and parcel of what we do in schools these days, leading all the way through to our year 12 with the great emphasis on ATAR and the results that come through ATAR.
And they're generally measuring the same sort of thing, you know, numeracy, language, literacy, cognitive skills, as well as emotional and physical abilities as well.
Yeah, there's a real emphasis on literacy and numeracy. And it's interesting that Brian talks about students not having to perform individually on these tests. Certainly in Western Australia, that's not the case for our year 9 students, where NAPLAN results are linked to the West Australian Certificate of Education, you know. So our kids in year 9 will now talk about whether or not they pass or fail NAPLAN.
So there's another level of pressure there.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a level of pressure and need to perform in those tests.
Is that concerning, Brian Caldwell, to hear that they are linked to now a pass or a fail?
In my view, yes, NAPLAN was never devised with that purpose in mind. I've got a fair understanding of how NAPLAN works. I served for 3 years as Deputy Chair of the Australian Curriculum Assessment and Reporting Authority. I've also studied, done case studies of many schools around Australia, and I've seen schools use these very effectively to identify their priorities for special needs for students. But that linkage, which is, of course, a state decision or a decision at the state level, goes beyond the initial intent, but would certainly add to the point that I've made that here's a level of pressure of external testing at a relatively early age that was not intended. I need to stress, I think, also that a lot depends on teachers' capacity to diagnose student needs. I was struck, for example, in Finland, where, by the way, almost every student, about 98% of students, attend a public or state school, that they have a practice in schools where if any student falls behind in any area by more than a couple of days, a whole team of teachers will work with those students and parents to help the students catch up. In fact, one can visit a school and find specialist staff who might be based in a part of the school, maybe even the staff room, who may get a pager call from a teacher who reports that some students are struggling a bit with a concept or a body of knowledge, and those teachers will immediately go to the room and assist the teacher by working individually with those students or setting up arrangements for work after school hours or with parents so that no student falls behind. So if we're really going to follow international best practice, the focus ought to be on the skills of teachers, school-level policies, and state-level policies.
And I guess that's where I would argue that, you know, the purpose of schools is, you know, carrying on from what you've said, Brian, to be responsive to the current and future needs of the students who sit in front of us in classrooms. And I guess the question that we have is how much does that testing take over the life of classrooms and take over the business of that responsiveness and that ability to adhere to those needs of students.
Well, what's your assessment there? How much has it taken over? I read somewhere that students in America, I think it was America, can be tested 20 to 25 hours a year is spent on testing. Has it taken over in your view, Esther?
Oh, look, I don't think it's taken over. I think there is an increasing accountability for schools, and that's seen in the public domain, which has a real impact on what schools feel that they should be doing. And the example of the Year 9s sitting their NAPLAN and having that potentially lead. I have to clarify there that there is an opportunity for students to then sit further tests in order to meet those requirements beyond Year 9, but certainly that increased accountability. And I guess it comes down to a question of, you know, what are the purposes that we have here in the classroom? Is it all about numeracy and literacy and standardised testing and doing well on tests and doing well in ATAR, or are there other purposes that we need to adhere to as well?
And we'll talk about that because that's where obviously your Beyond Boundaries Institute comes in. But are you feeling the pressure? Do students feel the pressure? Do teachers feel the pressure? And do schools, principals feel the pressure? I mean, because we get a lot of texts on this program from parents who worry about this and say it's limiting what you can do in the classroom now.
I think there's no doubt that there is an increasing focus on these tests and on ensuring at all levels that schools are performing to those external measures which are published and compared with other schools. I think that's absolutely the case.
And so what would you like to see? Less testing? As Brian talks about, sort of.
Yeah, I guess what I would like to see is that the emphasis is shifted so that we don't have this single single measure that we focus on in terms of how we see a school performing. So, you know, what are the other measures? So when you look at that data and you see that data published, what does that actually mean? Does it mean, yes, they're doing well in literacy and numeracy, but how are they going socially and emotionally? Or how are they developing their creativity and their ability to engage with the world and to understand different cultures?
You know, because you can't measure that in a test, can you?
Well, you can't measure it in the tests that we've got currently, I don't think.
So how could you measure it? Or is that where Brian talks about that's where the teacher is able to test that sort of stuff?
Yeah, and I guess that's where that autonomy and that responsiveness comes in. So I guess the policy levers of an Australian curriculum, which is very heavy in content, and testing regimes, which are very specific and narrow, means that the focus of what we do in schools is limited.
Is NAPLAN the biggest problem here?
I think NAPLAN is not the problem. I think the way in which NAPLAN is used and the emphasis on it, how much NAPLAN is taking over the classroom, how much time is spent in schools focusing on doing well in those tests, and what's being missed and lost in doing that.
What is being missed and lost?
And I guess that's where I would argue that the purpose of schooling is not only to do well in literacy and numeracy testing, but it's also a number of other things. You know, those capabilities that we hear so much about, that the Gonski Review that we heard recently emphasises. And where do we find the space to do those things if our emphasis is only on those standardised tests?
So what's the alternative, Professor Brian Caldwell? You talked there about introducing that plan a little later, for instance, because I read some comments from you back in 2012, and you predicted the demise of NAPLAN by 2020, which is only a couple of years away. Do you still believe NAPLAN could be phased out?
Yes, I do. And I'm glad you recovered those comments I made back in 2012, because I had at that point seen the harmful effects of league tables of schools. I think I picked out at that stage England, where all of the primary schools were ranked in order from 1 to 12,000 plus in daily newspapers to indicate their performance. And I was warning then against the use of tests in that way. But I was really there projecting what would happen if one developed in all teachers a capacity to assess well and more or less continuously in a way that ensured that the curriculum that the school was addressing matched and aligned well with state and national priorities. And providing the technology had been developed to support teachers. And I still think that's possible by 2020 or shortly after that. But look, let's face it, there's no question really at the moment that for weeks and weeks and weeks ahead of NAPLAN at each level, the schools are preoccupied with students doing the NAPLAN test. Now, some might say that ought not be the case because the tests really are or should be well aligned with the curriculum. But we've had enough experience with them now to address the realities. I did a review of teacher education in one Australian state a few years back, and discussions with a number of schools, they were telling us, please don't send us student teachers in the 2 months before NAPLAN because they'll be a distraction from our work in preparing for NAPLAN. And I thought, just how sad is that, that an important part of building a profession has to be sidelined because of this preoccupation with NAPLAN? And coming back to the point that Esther has made well, there are lots of ways schools can assess the progress that students are making in literacy and numeracy, yes, and making use of national tests where appropriate. But in areas like the general capabilities, as they're called, the problem solving, the creativity, and the various areas of the arts, we've known, and skillful teachers have known for decades, how to assess student progress and how to provide support for students in those areas. So either we need to recover those or develop them or take examples from schools that are doing outstandingly well in those respects and then sharing them among all schools. So hopefully it won't be too far beyond 2020 when we have got a much more diverse approach to assessing students and we're not dependent so much on the NAPLAN test.
And Esther, is that what teachers would prefer, do you think?
An ongoing kind of assessment. I mean, I'm not sure if they would prefer that. I think there is value in NAPLAN. There's value in that benchmarking. There's value in having that external read of how students are going. I guess what I would argue is that the overemphasis that there is on those results and the way in which they're used in the public domain, I think, really takes away from their usefulness, particularly when we have teachers, as Brian said, preparing students, you know, well in advance of the test. You know, they're supposed to be a little window into how students are performing, but in actual fact, they become the focus of a curriculum for students leading up to that time.
If you want to share your experiences today and what you've seen, what you observe with your children, how do they cope with the preparation involved and the pressure that's on them? 1300 222 720 is the number. We'd love to hear from you this morning, or you can text on 0437 922 720. And Anna says on the text, there's no time for the real wonder of learning and spontaneous conversations and the unravelling of philosophy and fantastic science experiments. It's all testing and paperwork. And this rather lengthy test, this text, I'm a junior primary teacher. I am stressed beyond belief. My beautiful class of delightful children are stressed. My colleagues and I have never seen the levels of stress in children that we are experiencing now, and the causes in no particular order. Overtesting. I have 6 standardised tests to give this term. It's ridiculous and it will not provide me with the data that I don't already know. I have an overcrowded, age-inappropriate curriculum. There is lack of play and discovery-based learning that teaches essential social skills and resilience in the early years. There is constant special days, competitions, grants that require evidence, incursions. Stressed teachers create stressed students, and on it goes.
And that's in pre-primary.
And that's in pre-primary. 6 standardised tests in one term? That's normal?
Well, that experience that's been so well described there, I think, would harmonise with the experiences of many teachers. It's interesting that as a country that outperforms us, that we regard as so different to us, and I'm thinking of Japan, the whole experience in the pre-primary, early years of primary is quite different. One can visit a primary school in Japan and see the most joyful learning, unencumbered play-based learning, where the enjoyment of the students interacting with each other and with teachers in highly creative and enjoyable work really stands out. It comes as a real eye-opener to teachers visiting from Australia. And yet those students, before too long, they gather their pace and perform well within their school and contribute well to their society and the economy, but without the excessive testing, which is quite alarming from that message that you read out.
How do you respond to that, what you've heard from that teacher? Because that's a worry, and I think I'd be safe to assume that there's probably a lot of others that heard that today and are nodding in agreement.
Absolutely. It's a real worry. And when you hear that description of Japanese schools and the focus on joy and love of learning, you know, I don't think anyone could argue that that is what we would like to see. I think it's sometimes there's a worry that if we have that joy and love of learning that we can't also have great standards in literacy and numeracy. And I don't think that these two things are mutually exclusive. I think there needs to be balance, and I think that's what we're hearing from the teacher who's written in about the pre-primary experience.
Nadia Mitsopoulos on ABC Radio Perth and on the ABC Listen app.
Nice to be with you this morning. We are talking about the testing of students and if students in Australia are being over-tested. Certainly Brian Caldwell thinks so. He's done a lot of research in this area. And when you look at the top performing education systems, the countries like Finland, Japan, Singapore, they don't do a lot of testing, they don't do a lot of streaming. Esther Hill is also here and she's also expressing some concerns. And we're going to hear a little bit more from Esther in a moment too about the Beyond Boundaries Institute, because they're doing some really interesting things. First though, let's have a chat to Andrew. Andrew, good morning.
Good morning, how are you?
Good, thanks Andrew. You're an employer. What do you see with the people that come through your business?
I get far too many people, up to probably the mid-late 20s, who can't read and write properly when they come for jobs. They have obviously gone through the education system and have never been tested and looked at to make sure that they can actually function in a work environment. And reading and writing has got to be the top level.
What's the extent of that? And are these generally people who've gone through to Year 12?
Generally, most of them will be Year 10. Lately, a lot of them have gone through Year 12. I just don't understand how they're coming through the system without being able to read and write properly. It's better now. The past 4 or 5 years has definitely have seen a marked improvement. Prior to that, back in the early 2000s, it was just some of them were unemployable.
Yeah.
Because they couldn't read or write.
Yeah.
You couldn't give them written instructions and expect them to write back and let you know what they've done.
Andrew,
but
thank...
testing has to be done to keep the teachers and the students accountable and make them employable.
Andrew, thank you very much for that. Appreciate your insights. David wants to talk about what happens in Japan. Hi, David.
Hi, good morning. I just say there's no point in throwing lots of money again to education if the mindset amongst the parents and the school itself isn't promoting education. In Japan, every single parent will make sure that their kids put 100% into education. I question whether that's the case in Australia.
So more parent involvement? Is too much being left to the teachers? Is that what you say?
Absolutely. My wife's a deputy head, and the skill set that she is required is just unbelievable. I think that parents must take more responsibility to make sure that their children want to learn. The importance of education is not stressed enough.
I guess responding to the first caller there, the idea that we have students coming out of the system which has a lot of standardised testing without that literacy and numeracy, I guess it begs the question, you know, what is the impact nationally? And Brian, you might be able to talk about this, Brian. What's the impact of this national testing in terms of improving literacy and numeracy?
Well, the evidence in front of us tells us that Australia has really flatlined in terms of the results of NAPLAN. And on the international tests, we've really gone backwards compared to high-performing countries. So some schools can use the results of NAPLAN tests and other tests very, very well to diagnose needs. But the key thing is do staff, that's teachers and their leaders, including principals, have the skills to use the data well then to make changes in the way they go about their work? And is the curriculum appropriate? And in that regard, I'd highlight two things. One is that the employer view is consistent and consistent with the view of your caller, and that is literacy and numeracy is the foundation. But great emphasis is being placed now in recent reports from industry groups about the importance of problem solving, working cooperatively in groups, teamwork and the like, which come close to the general capabilities in the Australian curriculum. So NAPLAN is useful in one to some extent, but the real solutions lie elsewhere. There's another interesting point made by your second caller who was pointing out the high level of trust that parents have, high level of value they place on school education. And that was another major finding in our international research, that really Australia is a low trust country when it comes to how the community at large views the efforts of governments and schools generally in education. Whereas in Finland, there's almost a mantra that everybody trusts the schools, and within the schools, everybody trusts the teachers. Finland and Estonia nearby, they're high trust countries. And that really is a big handicap, I think. And until we can build that level of trust, and there are a whole lot of strategies that we can use to do that, that's always going to be a drag on our efforts in schools to lift the levels of achievement of all students.
Do you see that, Esther? Because I think when you talk about trust too, I think back in my day, a long time ago when I was at school, I think parents had absolute trust in teachers. And whenever there was an issue, they took the teacher's side pretty quickly. I find that's not the case now. I think some parents are very quick to criticise teachers, and I don't know. What do you see? But I do feel there's been a shift there.
I think in the community that I work in, there's a real partnership between families and teachers, and we do very much emphasise that idea of working in partnership, and it sounds like that reflects what happens in Japan. I think this idea of trust and mistrust perhaps comes more from the intervention of government into education, in terms of that sort of sense of that teachers feel of being mistrusted, and that the need for surveillance of what they're doing and therefore testing.
Interesting way of putting it.
Yeah.
It is a form of surveillance. A couple of texts. Sally says, I'm a recently retired early childhood teacher and totally agree with the email from the other teacher of too much intervention in the early years. Too much load on teachers, and teachers to what effect? Yet research has proven consistently that social and emotional development is the highest priority in those years. There is way too much testing of information, and most teachers already know all of that about a child. Thank you. And Michael says, I was a teacher in state schools for almost 50 years, and I've seen a lot of developments in education. Australia has slipped in world tables over that time. NAPLAN is a toxic test, and not only wastes a lot of teaching and learning time in preparation and administration, but it is a massive distraction from the real-life, content-rich, creative, problem-solving and collaborative learning. Finland does not test students in high-stakes testing until their final year. There are much better ways of knowing students' progress other than formal standardised testing. And Anne says, we are destroying our young people's joy of learning, and we wonder why we have such a level of mental health issues. We all have to take a step back, parents included. I think overarching parental fear has driven much of this, and it becomes self-fulfilling through more and more and more testing. It is a self-feeding monster. And on that point, Esther, It limits what a teacher can do in a classroom, doesn't it? Because you talk a lot about, well, your program, which does look very much, there is individualised learning, but you go beyond those boundaries at your Beyond Boundaries Institute. What does it do? Because it does limit you, doesn't it?
Yeah, I guess the way that we see it is we see it as a set of constraints through which we need to ensure that we design programs that do that thing that we're talking about, which is be responsive to the needs of current and future needs of our students. And so the Institute and what we're doing at All Saints is really a platform for us to research and develop and trial programs which address those needs and allow our students to have more than standardised testing and literacy and numeracy, but that we're actually working very hard to develop those capabilities.
So what are you doing? I understand you, for instance, you do quite a bit of entrepreneurial learning, and it's not about teaching kids to become entrepreneurs and become rich, but so creating business opportunities and solving problems.
Yeah, entrepreneurial learning we define as teaching students to add value to the lives of others. You know, to be entrepreneurial is to add value to the lives of others. So we have an innovation program which runs through year 7 to 10, which gives space and time to students to be able to develop their creativity and their problem solving. We have a service learning program where students, and currently we're just developing Catalyst, which is our Centre for Social Enterprise. So we're teaching young people to be able to take on the problems of the world and to be active agents in solving those problems.
And that allows for more individual pathways?
Individual pathways, I guess, is another kind of element of that. So we're very much involved in mapping individual pathways for students that not necessarily the ATAR or the general mm-hmm. pathway are the two pathways that are there. There are many pathways, and we often say that there are as many measures of success as there are students in a school. And so working out what individual students need is very much a priority for us.
And you partner with industry?
Yeah, partnering with industry, partnering with groups out in the community, partnering with tertiary institutions as well so that we can map those programs.
Okay. Let's go to Linda. Linda, good morning.
Good morning.
What do you want to say?
Right. Oh, multiple things. I'll make it in very quick point form. One is I emigrated to Australia with my family in 1965. I failed my 11 plus, and when I came to Australia, I had numerous opportunities. I had numerous jobs. I took on some opportunities for traineeships in medical science. I've now got a PhD. I have taught for over 35 years in high schools, TAFE colleges, universities, numerous research opportunities, and I'm thinking that this bloody NAPLAN drives me insane because there's too much intensity on testing and teaching to test. Now, I have also worked in environments where kids have been, and adults, and particularly women, who have come back into training with no sense of self-esteem or identity. They've gone on to do lots of wonderful things. They've progressed on to small-based training programs onto universities. And the thing is, what you need to do is start listening to the needs of people, needs of students, smaller class sizes. Nobody gets the idea that you can't teach a class of 30 kids with problems with their families. Smaller classes, 20, maybe 15 in the practical classes, that's the way to go. We need to re-look at how we educated young people, older people, females and older men.
Linda, thank you very much for that. Appreciate your insights. I'll finish up with Julie. Julie, hello.
Hi, how you going?
Yeah, yes, good. Thanks, Julie.
Yeah, look, I just think they need to think about scrapping the NAP plan after 10 years and refunding it and having every class from kindy up to year 12, there should be a teacher and an EA, reducing the numbers to under 25, because I've got two children have just finished up with school and are working, and I've got two at the end of school. Now, I was a parent that always read books and that, but I'm still astounded that a couple of my children, just their basic spelling and that is atrocious. And I've done as much as I can, and I do see the problems now that there is less input from parents. There's such much social issues and problems out there. But the money could be refunded, I think, by looking at having two teachers every class. It needs to be.
Oh, wouldn't that be a luxury, Julie? Wouldn't it just? Thank you very much. And this text from Sue. Olna, and I'll explain what that is demoralising and unnecessary. Both my children have had to do it and passed the first time but felt somehow stupid because they had to do it. They both scored high band 7 in year 9 NAP plan, band 8 being the cutoff. They're also both young for their school years. They were always going to be capable of passing Olna, but they had their self-esteem impacted along the way. Now, Olna is the online literacy and numeracy assessment, and it is designed for secondary students to successfully meet the minimum standard of literacy and numeracy. And that you need that to get your WS Certificate of Education.
So that's either Year 9 NAT plan. So you either pre-qualify with Year 9 NAT plan. So that's the passing, failing NAT plan.
Yep.
And if you don't pass NAT plan in Year 9, then you need to sit the online literacy and numeracy tests. And, you know, that's our experience as well, that, you know, those students then have to engage with that test as many times as they can. So they get 6 opportunities to pass that test in order to get their WAE certificate.
In conclusion, Brian Caldwell, what is the immediate answer here? Is your desire, as you mentioned earlier, to see the end of NAT plan and then what? What do you replace it with?
I replace it with a highly skilled teacher and teacher support professional network in every school, in every location. Folk who can assess well, folk who can develop programs that will enable every student to catch up if they fall behind. Where it's possible to do so, have every school do the sorts of things that Esther described at All Saints, but which many state schools are doing as well, but also be alert to the needs of students in remote regions where, for example, large numbers of students, English is their third, fourth or even fifth language. So having a uniform one best way approach in a single state, let alone across a whole country, just doesn't work anymore. So I think the needs have been identified in the program and some possible strategies have also been described.
This is a difficult area for governments, though, isn't it? Because, as you mentioned at the beginning of this program, it is very complex, and I don't see a willingness from the federal government anytime soon to be wanting to hand all the control of the curriculum over to states.
Well, at the moment, the curriculum, as a national curriculum, is not in the hands of the federal government. It's in the hands of the Australian Curriculum Assessment and Reporting Authority, and every state and territory is involved in that, and the federal minister is just one member out of many. And then at the state level, there is adaptation or integration of that curriculum. But my view is that the federal minister could well step outside of this role in school education so that we don't have a federal minister, just as Canada doesn't have a federal minister responsible for school education. If the ministers work together, as what I've called in the book that reports these findings, the book is The Alignment Premium, all ministers can work together in a council. We can have a council of education ministers in Australia who can ensure effective coordination, just as they have in Canada, a council of education ministers Canada. So that's the sort of role that I would like to see evolve in the next few years. Once we get past the next federal parliament, that would then enable us to match the way schools are governed in the high-performing countries.
And Esther, what would you like to see change?
I guess I would like to see the space for that responsiveness and the autonomy to be able to respond to the needs of the kids who sit in front of us day to day in our classrooms, and that the purpose of education is attended to, that education is not only to pass literacy and numeracy tests. It's not only about passing tests. It's also, there are many other things that we would like education to achieve, and that we need to make sure that we're attending to those things at the same time as attending to literacy and numeracy.
Need flexibility, a bit
Absolutely.
Of freedom. Interesting chat. Professor Brian Caldwell and Esther Hill, really appreciate your time this morning.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Right, thank you very much. Been a very good conversation.